VOA One the Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Friedel, Gregory Stockel, Dan Novak, and Katie Weaver. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Dan Friedel.
The search continues for survivors of a building collapse near Miami, Florida, on June 24th. At least 11 people died when parts of the 12-floor building fell, and 150 remain missing. As each day passes, the chance of finding people alive in the building known as Champlain Towers South decreases. Now, people who live nearby in Champlain Towers North are wondering if they should leave. North was built in 1982, 1 year after South, by the same company, using the same materials and a similar design. Just one block away, the nearly 40-year-old building has also faced the same seawater and salty air as South. Some who live in Champlain Towers North feel their building is safer than the South building. They say their building does not have the same structural problems that were described in the South's 2018 engineering reports. The report says the South building had major structural damage and needed extensive repairs. Charles Burkett is the mayor of Surfside, the town that is home to the two buildings. He said a quick inspection of the North building, done after the South's collapse, did not show any problems, but that did not make everyone feel safe. Rebecca Weinstock owns an apartment in Champlain Towers North. She was in New York when South fell. "I'm petrified of returning," she said. Weinstock said she will only return if two independent building engineers, not from Florida, agree the building is safe. Philip and Nora Zine said about 25% of North residents have left the building, but they are staying in their fifth-floor apartment. "I'm not worried at all right now," Philip Zine said. But he added that he wants a full engineering and scientific review of the building. I'm Dan Friedel.
Many companies are making changes to their offices to help employees feel safer as they return to work after more than 1 year of coronavirus restrictions. Some are improving office air systems or are moving desks farther apart. Others are removing desks and building more conference rooms for employees who work at home but come into the office for meetings. Steelcase is an office furniture company based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It says research shows half of companies around the world plan to redesign their office space this year. Natalie Angles works as a designer at the architecture business Gensler. She said the past year has made people think, why do we go to an office? Not every company is making changes, and Angles noted that they do not have to. She tells her customers to remember what worked well and what did not before the coronavirus health crisis. But designers say many companies want to make employees feel safe and energized at the office. This is especially the case as some businesses report a labor shortage. The food and drug company Ajinomoto redesigned its North American headquarters near Chicago last year based on those concerns. Ajinomoto's employees returned to work in May. The building had wider walking spaces and glass divisions between workspaces. This was to give workers more room and to make them feel more secure. To improve mental health, the company added a relaxation room. A test kitchen was set up for online presentations. In addition to that, a cleaning crew disinfects the office 2 times a day. Ryan Smith is the executive vice president of Ajinomoto North America. He admits the efforts might be too much, but it could help those who have concerns about returning to work in the office. Smith estimates 40% of the new headquarters design was changed. Shobha Surya, an employee at Ajinomoto, is energized by the space. She said, "The office gives you a balance of work and home life." She said it was easier to keep her attention at the office now, and she is happy to be working with her coworkers again. Lise Newman is with the architecture business Smith Group. She said when employees are asked what they miss most about the office, they say socializing and working with colleagues. Companies are trying to build relationships between employees by having more social areas. Some have areas that look like a coffee shop. Newman said, companies are trying to create that sense that this is a cool club that people want to come into. Mark Bryan is a designer at M&A Architects based in Columbus, Ohio. He expects that, in the future, an office will have different places to work in on any given day. Some workers might choose a small private room, and others might choose a table in the office eating area. Some office changes show the new mixture of working from home and at the office. Based in New York, Valiant Technologies provides technical support and other services to businesses. It is letting its employees work mostly from home. Employees request a desk if they want to come into the office. The company has removed desks and has put more spaces between the remaining ones. Employees leave equipment in safe storage areas. Not every design change will stay. Steelcase brought back some employees last summer. They pushed tables in the cafeteria far apart from each other and only permitted one person to sit at a table. Steelcase's chief, Jim Keane, said it made the space so sad that no one wanted to sit there. He said he learned that workspaces need to be safe, but they also need to be inspiring. He said people are actually going to expect more from offices in the future. I'm Gregory Stockel.
Several American states have proposed new legislation and policies controlling how the history of race and slavery is taught in public schools. Some single out the New York Times 1619 Project as misrepresenting U.S. history. The project argues that 1619 could be considered as the nation's birth year. That was when the first slave ship arrived in colonial Virginia. It says doing so requires us to place the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center of the story we tell ourselves about who we are as a country. Conservative lawmakers and officials in several American states, however, see that as a problem. In early June, the Board of Education in the state of Florida voted to ban the teaching of the 1619 Project and critical race theory. Critical race theory is an idea of how racism and white supremacy have shaped U.S. society, laws, and policies. The board said the project distorts historical events. The board added that teachers may not define American history as something other than the creation of a new nation based largely on ideas from the Declaration of Independence. The education publication Chalkbeat says lawmakers in Arkansas, Michigan, Missouri, and North Dakota have also tried to pass policies preventing the teaching of the 1619 Project.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is the creator of the 1619 Project. She said it is not supposed to replace what schools traditionally teach, but it is supposed to ask people to think about what came from slavery. Since its release in August 2019, the project has been used in history and social studies classes across the country, including Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C. Rebecca Milner teaches U.S. history at Eastern High School in Washington, D.C., and uses several essays from the project in the class. Good luck to not wanting to teach about the legacies of slavery and systemic racism and have kids get a good handle on U.S. history, she said. I don't know how districts are doing that. Last year, students from her class organized a day-long event based around the 1619 Project. Students planned a museum-like experience to teach the school and community members about the ideas behind the project.
Some students dressed and acted as famous Black activists. Other students read poetry. The school musical group sang old songs first sung by enslaved people. At one station, students drew or wrote their feelings in answer to sayings from the project. At another, students filled out family trees. one station served as a memorial. Christian is a black student at Eastern High. With the school marching band, he played drum beats to show how enslaved people used beats to secretly communicate with each other. The presentation, he said, showed how some music has roots in enslaved black people. Everything that we have nowadays, it was formed back when we were in a harder time. The central message of the day was to not let history go untold or unseen, Christian said. Milner said the ideas central to the 1619 Project, that slavery was important to the founding of the country and that African Americans fight for freedom is good for the whole country, are not new. But she said the way the information is presented in the project reaches students better than books and other resources. The 1619 Project connects those messages in such a powerful way for students, she said.
Rebecca Coven is an English and social studies teacher at Sullivan High School in Chicago. The school has mostly black students. She said the project shows students the importance of perspective when it comes to writing history. The 1619 Project is almost entirely written by black writers. It gets us to think about who gets to write history, and how does that story determine what we know about the world, Coven said. Many times, she added, students learn about slavery from a white perspective. With that in mind, students in Coven's second-year English class wrote their own version, called the 1619 Project, Sullivan Edition. Instead of writing about the impact of slavery and racism on the entire nation, the class focused on their impact in Chicago. Students wrote about the root causes of social problems like the wealth gap, inequality in education, and America's large prison system. The students' project includes discussions and surveys with students and school officials about racism and other issues. It also contains poetry and drawings. With this project, I wanted students to understand how slavery created a social hierarchy that still impacts our institutions today, Coven said.
Raymond is a student in Coven's class. He wrote about the historical reasons why black Americans are less trusting of the healthcare system and less likely to get the COVID-19 vaccine. He said spreading knowledge of these issues could help create change. It is important to learn about the unfortunate history instead of trying to paint America as this perfect place, he said. I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Theodore Roosevelt, the 26th President of the United States. Many Americans like to call him Teddy Roosevelt, or even TR. These nicknames for the president show that Roosevelt was, in general, popular with the public. He is one of the four presidents whose face can be seen on Mount Rushmore, a memorial to famous U.S. leaders. Historians note that Roosevelt's term in office marks the beginning of the modern presidency. In other words, he expanded the position and used the media to connect with the public. Among Americans, His public image is often linked to youth, energy, strength, courage, and playfulness. But his image has also been linked to a strong liking for military action and for oneself. Theodore Roosevelt is also often tied to the American West, but he was born and raised on the East Coast in New York City. His father was a wealthy businessman. His mother was from a Southern planter family that owned slaves. Theodore Roosevelt had two sisters and a brother. His family called him by another nickname, Teddy. When he was a boy, young Theodore was often sick. He had asthma, a lung condition that could make physical activity difficult. So, as he got older, Roosevelt strengthened his body. For the rest of his life, he strongly believed in physical exercise and vigorous activity, what he called the strenuous life. Young Roosevelt also had hunger for learning. He studied with private tutors, traveled overseas, and studied many subjects while in college at Harvard. After his college years, he studied law briefly and then began serving in public office in New York. But tragedy halted his early government service. Roosevelt had married Alice Hathaway Lee, who soon became pregnant. But 2 days after the baby was born, Roosevelt's wife died of kidney disease. And as it happened, Roosevelt's mother died on the same day, in the same house. She suffered from Bright's disease, another disorder affecting the kidneys. The future president was struck by grief. He left his baby daughter with his sister and went to the American West. There, Roosevelt lived as a cowboy, hunting, riding horses, taking part in cattle drives, and even chasing people who broke the law. The experience helped define Roosevelt's life and beliefs. But after 2 years, he was ready to return to the East Coast. There, he married Edith Kermit Caro, a woman he had known since childhood. They settled in a house on Long Island, New York, and raised Roosevelt's daughter, Alice. He and Edith also had 5 other children. His family supported Roosevelt's rise in Republican Party politics, including his campaign to become governor of New York. But some of the party officials were not happy with Roosevelt. They did not like his independence, and they did not want him to be reelected as governor. So they plotted to have him nominated as U.S. Vice President in the election of 1900. They believed Roosevelt would not be able to give them much trouble in that position. As the Republican leaders hoped, Roosevelt and the sitting president, William McKinley, won both the popular and electoral vote in a landslide. But less than a year later, McKinley was dead. And with that, Republican leaders found that the man they wanted to get out of their way was now the country's 26th president. When he became president, Roosevelt was only 42 years old. He is still the youngest person to hold that office. At first, Roosevelt promised to continue the policies of McKinley, who was, after all, the president voters had reelected. But Roosevelt quickly put his own mark on the presidency. He is known for trying to balance the needs of many groups in society, including business owners, farmers, and workers. Roosevelt called his program the square deal. In other words, he suggested that everyone was treated fairly. However, some Americans objected to Roosevelt reducing the power of big businesses. They said his use of government rules, in general, did not let market forces operate freely. Roosevelt is also known for protecting the nation's wilderness areas. He set aside more than 800,000 square kilometers of land to protect nature and wildlife. In his foreign policy, Roosevelt was energetic. He helped Panama win independence from Colombia in order to start building the Panama Canal. He also defended, and even added to, the Monroe Doctrine, an idea from the presidency of James Monroe. Roosevelt confirmed that the United States would bar European powers from intervening in South America, and, more than that, that the U.S. would police the Western Hemisphere and make sure that countries honored their international obligations. In other words, Roosevelt believed the United States had the right and responsibility to be a world power. If diplomatic negotiations did not work, he was not afraid to threaten the use of force. He famously said, "Speak softly and carry a big stick. You will go far." Voters approved of Roosevelt's actions, or at least they enjoyed his leadership and his young family that played all over the White House. In 1904, Roosevelt easily won the presidency in his own right. He is the first vice president who took power after the death of a sitting president to earn his own term. Although he was permitted to seek another term as president, Roosevelt promised not to. He left the White House in 1909, still a very young man. For a while, he traveled overseas, but when he returned home, he did not like the direction the new president and the Republican Party was going. So Roosevelt created a new political group called the Progressive Party, or as some called it, the Bull Moose Party. Not surprisingly, the term Bull Moose was meant to suggest Roosevelt and his animal-like strength. Although he earned many votes, Roosevelt did not win the 1912 election. Instead, he split the votes of the Republican Party and permitted a Democrat to win the presidency. Roosevelt's efforts were not entirely lost, however. Later presidents, including Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson, used many of his ideas for reform. And major U.S. political parties today often find lessons from Roosevelt's presidency they admire or support. Both Democrat Bill Clinton and Republican George W. Bush said Theodore Roosevelt was one of their role models. In the years after the 1912 election, Roosevelt remained active. He traveled, campaigned, and continued to try to influence politics from his home in New York, where he died unexpectedly in his sleep at age 60. One public official observed, "Death had to take Roosevelt sleeping, for if he had been awake, there would have been a fight." I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.